This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. If you listen to NPR news programs, you're already familiar with the work of my guest, John Hockenberry. He just returned to the States from Jerusalem, where for close to 2 years he covered the Middle East for NPR. Many of his stories followed the Intifada, the Palestinian uprising. But while he was overseas, he also went to Iran to cover the funeral of the Ayatollah and to Romania to cover the overthrow of Nicolae Ceausescu. According to the LA Times, Hockenberry became something of a legend in the Middle East, among reporters, and among the growing legion of wounded and disabled Palestinians, because of his remarkable mobility in his wheelchair. He's paralyzed from the waist down as a result of a spinal cord injury 14 years ago. John Hockenberry has worked for NPR since 1981. He won a Peabody Award for his story of a 13-year-old who was shot in the back and lost the use of his legs. Another of his celebrated pieces was about a radio DJ with Tourette syndrome. Hockenberry will be hosting a new NPR late-night program called Heat. It premieres on many public radio stations in March. I asked him about why he wanted the Middle East assignment.
Well, actually, I wanted some kind of foreign position, overseas position. I mean, it was very frustrating for me in 1982 when I was a newscaster, for all things considered, covering the Israeli invasion of Lebanon. There just seemed to, you know, Shiites were the crazy people. The Israelis were the tragically flawed, you know, stalwart soldierly heroes trying to do something that we all sort of understood to be right. And then the Palestinians were the, you know, poor, you know, dark-skinned third world victims. And that was as sophisticated as it got in the American coverage. And when you're doing a newscast, you know, you're kind of really a prisoner of the information coming in off the wires, you know, which has been filtered through about 10,000 different Western filters. And I really felt as though I wanted personally to have a much better context for what the heck it was that was going on in the Middle East. So I had spent a lot of time studying about the Middle East, but again, never expecting to go. So all of those things kind of went vroom together when the position opened.
I think there are really very few precedents for foreign correspondents who use wheelchairs. And I was wondering if you had frank talks with your editors about what it would be like to overcome the logistical problems getting around in the Middle East.
In a wheelchair?
Yeah.
You mean, you think I'm in a wheelchair? I've always wanted to do that on the air, Terry. I just, it's part of the magic of radio.
I'm sorry
it had to be you, but I've just always wanted to do that to someone. I've imagined it for years, and I'm a very bad disabled person. We actually didn't discuss it. I mean, yes, I am in a wheelchair, and lest there be no doubt. And Mom, no, nothing's changed. It was a strange kind of discussion. I'm trying to recall it now. I mean, the NPR editors, and editors are always this way, I think, whether they're with NPR or something, they're just like, well, John, you know, you'll just have to handle it, right? You know, and I mean, okay, yeah, sure. But they didn't understand what the problems were going to be. And I really didn't understand what the problems were going to be either. I mean, I had this sense that actually it would be a heck of a lot easier outside of the United States reporting than it ever was in New York or Chicago or the Pacific Northwest. And indeed, that is what it turned out to be. I mean, I think physically it's very exhausting to, if you happen to be disabled and working in a foreign beat.
I heard that there's because of all the fighting in the Middle East, there's so many people with disabilities that there's maybe more accommodations made for it.
Actually, that's absolutely not the case.
Really?
It's shocking, really. I mean, whether you're in Iraq, in the Iran-Iraq war, in Iran or Iraq, or just simply in Israel, even. And if you're in Israel or if you're in the occupied territories, I mean, Israel has had extraordinary injuries among its population because of the wars. The Palestinians have had extraordinary injuries, especially during the Palestinian uprising, that have caused permanent disabling situations. You just never see these people. I think it was very strange. I mean, I always felt like I was the only disabled person in the universe in any of these places. I mean, in the case of Israel, I think there's a real problem physically with people sort of coming out and being out in the streets and stuff. They sort of hang around in their cars, and the government gives them cars. And I mean, I don't know if this makes much sense, but you kind of understand this sort of compensatory mentality, because, I mean, if you've come out of a physically disabled, you know, hospital setting, and, you know, you have a car for a while, and then you kind of have to make this psychological jump to sort of be out, because there's a tremendous tendency if you're a disabled person to kind of hang in a little rut that's safe to you. And in Israel. I was amazed to the extent to which these people had done this. In the Arab world, it's I think, if anything, it's even worse. I think people are taught to kind of, you know, pray for a miracle, and there are great difficulties getting quality medical care in the occupied territories, partially because of the Israelis. Mostly because of the Israelis, but there's also psychological barriers, and I noticed this all over the Third World. But in for me, that's what made it easy. I mean, I sort of would come in there and, hi, I need to go up 5 flights of steps to interview, you know, Ahmed bin Ahmed. And suddenly there were 50 people, and we were all going upstairs, and, you know, then I had 50 more people to interview if I wanted. And, you know, it's kind of an international symbol of, you know, wheelchair at bottom of the stairs.
Do you ever get nervous if you were parted from your wheelchair? You know, like, say someone stole it or something? This is the kind of thing I would worry about.
Well, the only time I actually worried about this was at Khomeini's funeral, which was a complete logistical nightmare. I mean, first of all, it's Khomeini's funeral. Second of all, there's 10 million other people there. And third, or 5 million other people there. Third, I mean, I was, you know, from this non-existent public radio network as far as the Iranians are concerned, and I'm American anyway, so, you know, and the New York Times and all the rest of the press corps are there, so you have to figure out some way of getting on, like, the helicopters first, for instance, and everyone was trying to get on these helicopters to go and view from above Khomeini's funeral to get a sense of the scale of the crowd, because we were being kept sequestered, pretty much. And I remember this guy just comes up behind me as I'm rolling, and he wouldn't leave me alone. He's trying to push me, and he's pushing all, you know, pushing me here and pushing me there, and I'm just like, you know, thank you very much. And, you know, nice guy. He doesn't speak any English, so, you know, I couldn't actually talk to him, but there he was pushing me. And so he realized that I wanted to get on the helicopter, and the New York Times and the Washington Post and NBC News are all there with their, you know, Iranian fixers who are thinking, please, we have to go very, very soon, very quickly now. And they're trying to, you know, strong-arm their way onto the helicopter first. And this little, thin Iranian guy, dear man, starts screaming something at this Iranian National Guardsman. And suddenly, boom, I'm in the front of the line. And I get into the helicopter, and I can't take the wheelchair into the helicopter. And the helicopter lifts off the ground, and here's this little guy running away with my wheelchair, you know, to sort of save it for me. And I guess there was really nothing to do at that point. I mean, I guess, well, we'll come back, and there'll either be a wheelchair there or there won't be, you know.
Well, how did you hook up with it again?
Look, the helicopter comes back after 5 minutes, and here's this guy running around in the parking lot. He sees the helicopter, he memorized the number or something, and he knew exactly when I was coming back or something, and there he was again. And I guess the lesson is, you know, if you can't trust someone on the day of Khomeini's funeral who you've known for 10 minutes with your wheelchair, who can you trust? It was the only time I ever worried about it, but, you know, these things are, oddly enough, much more of a problem in the United States than they are in the West than they are in the Third World. I mean, I can't imagine, you know, getting upstairs in the city of New York or Los Angeles or Chicago. I mean, if I was doing an interview or something and I was down somewhere on the street and I needed to go up 5 steps, I mean, Americans typically respond to this sort of thing with a kind of a, oh, God, oh, are you lost? Oh, I'll call somebody. I mean, what's the 800 number? I mean, I paid this tax. I mean, this is disgusting. I thought we took care of this problem, you know, but they won't help you. I mean, they can't actually lift you up the stairs. So that was really quite good. I mean, I wish I could go back.
My guest is NPR reporter John Hockenberry, and he just returned from nearly 2 years covering the Middle East for NPR, and now he's about to host a new daily late-night talk show called Heat, which will debut on many public radio stations in March. You left in March of 88 to become, right, to report on the Middle East. The Intifada, the Palestinian uprising, was kind of at its height then. How did you see it change during the, year and a half or so that you were there?
The uprising is an event in a set of political realities which have not changed since before the 1940s, really. I mean, the 1967 war was a change of borders, but clearly the Israelis have not come to, and the Zionist Jews who constituted Israel have not dealt with the presence of an indigenous Arabic population. Similarly, for a whole variety of reasons, the people who are politically responsible in the Arab world have not dealt with the presence of Israel. The uprising itself was one in a series of eruptions, because the situation is completely unresolvable. And if you're there, you understand that it's not resolvable in any traditional sense that we understand in the West. And it transformed itself, and I could feel this happening in me, into a war of attrition, and that's very much where it stands now. It's a very mean-spirited, bloody conflict that's, you know, killing, you know, Arab young people, you know, one or two per day. And, you know, now we don't hear about it because there's no political miracles in the Middle East. That's the place that distinguishes it from somewhere like Eastern Europe, where, you know, Steven Spielberg could perhaps imagine the special effects going on there. But in the Middle East, it's the same old story.
John, can I ask you for an example of a story that was particularly challenging for you in terms of the ethics or the point of view? You know, where you understood what the two sides were and you had to decide how to present those two sides?
I think there was no particular story, but you would always encounter things that where people would say things in context, and you know, you would have real difficulty airing them, or you would air them and you would get all kinds of inflammatory response. I can certainly remember very early when I got there, a couple of boys, this is in the middle of Israel's Independence Day celebration, which is it's kind of a family riot that takes place in Tel Aviv and especially in Jerusalem, where people run around and hit each other with plastic hammers and spray, silly foam on each other. It's not drunken at all, but it is very wild. But anyway, in the middle of this are all these kids, and they're celebrating the Independence Day of Israel. And I asked them, "What you want to do when you grow up, and what's going on?" And the two kids said, "I want to kill Arabs." And then they laughed and said, "No, not really." And I said, "Well, but what do you want to do?" "Well, we want to join the army, and we want to, be heroes." And, you know, "Well, what will you do in the army?" "Well, we'll kill Arabs." And so, I mean, I aired a part of that. I was just very nervous about it. And indeed, there was all kinds of consternation and criticism leveled at the network for airing it, some of it internal, some of it external. Whereas, you know, if you were down in New York City, in the Bronx, and you were talking to two white kids for an interview on racism, and the two white kids said, "Yeah, I want to grow up and kill blacks," you would never have a hesitation to air this. I mean, because it would say something about some aspect of the community. I mean, you would set it in a certain context, and indeed I attempted to do that in Israel all the time. But the linguistic categories are so charged with voltage that you bump into these pitfalls all the time. You get kind of scared of the things that you see, and you feel very strongly a kind of self-censorship.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask you a few questions about yourself?
Sure.
About your own background. Can you tell me about the accident that left your legs paralyzed? I think it was an auto accident when you were younger.
It was a car accident, and it was a terrible car accident, and it's a long time ago, 14 years ago now, almost exactly, it seems like another life. It really does. I was 19. Uh-huh. I was like in school, man, I'm going to hitchhike to New York, from Chicago. We were going to have like a really crazy weekend. And it was the worst hitchhiking ride I ever took.
The accident was while you were hitching?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. But why do you say, "Oh boy"? A lot of people say, everyone says, "Oh, it was hitching. Oh." What do you mean?
Well, I used to hitchhike a lot when I was younger, when I was in college. And I remember a few rides with some really crazy people where I thought, well, you blew it this time. And it's the sense of really not having control. Now, right. I don't know whether these were competent drivers or not who you were hitching with, but I had some pretty close calls hitchhiking. Yeah. And I look back at that and really wonder how and why I did it.
Well, these people had been driving all night.
I see.
They fell asleep at the wheel, or she fell asleep at the wheel. Mm-hmm. But, my mother's response is really weird because she would say, "Well, you shouldn't have been hitchhiking." because I used to get in trouble all the time with the juvenile authorities when I was a teenager, because I'd hitchhike and they'd give me tickets, and I'd, you know, tell the policeman something about the Bill of Rights, you know, and you know, my mother would have to be dragged in to this, you know, juvenile place to be told, you know, that the police of the city do not need lectures on the Constitution by a teenager, and maybe this means there's something wrong, you know, with your son, Mrs. Hockenberry. And so I remember she would say, well, you shouldn't have been hitchhiking. You know, we used to laugh at her about that. But, you know, it took a long time. I mean, it was a serious injury. It took a long time to, you know, sort of get back on your feet. I think actually the incident of the accident itself is less significant to me now as an event, as the, you know, the transformations that take place over a really an extraordinary period of time. 14 years, when you think about it, to sort of come to fully sort of acquire a new life, and that's really what happens. And partially going away to the Middle East, doing an overseas assignment, you know, it's an extension of that. You try to figure out exactly how free you can actually be physically, and well. Lots of people do that by climbing mountains or something, or being some sort of super grip athlete. That had never any attraction to me whatsoever. Never.
Well, had you been athletic or, you know, very, very physical person before the accident?
Oh, no, I was a clumsy oaf. I actually, with four wheels on the ground now, I'm like, you know, Nureyev, you know? But you know, on two legs, no, I was a complete oaf. But I actually enjoy it. I'm actually more athletic now, in a sense. I mean, I enjoy, you know, running or something, like, you know, doing distance running. It's actually kind of a fun way to get around if you have a, you know, a good fast chair. But I don't do it for any kind of competition, and I just don't have time. I'd much rather, you know, explore, I guess, is the way of saying it.
Now, tell me if this is an apocryphal story. I've heard that you were doing all these freelance assignments for the news editors at NPR in Washington, and that they had no idea that you were getting around on a wheelchair. And when they found out while you were filing a Mount St. Helens story on the volcano, that they were just really astonished.
Well, the story actually goes like this, and I, you know, I may be remembering it wrong, but I think this is how it goes. Only my editor really knew, Adrienne Chufo, at the time, who's since left. I think she works for some other company in Washington. But she was my editor in the beginning, and I had a big crush on her at the time also, which she'll, you know, she'll know about anyway. But she protected me, and she kept all this, you know, information that might damage my career from any of the other editors and stuff. And so we were very secretive about this thing. But one day she was absent. And her boss, John McChesney, who was a foreign editor for NPR for a while, he was running this particular unit, and I was editing with him. And I missed a deadline because I was out in the middle of this eastern Washington desert, dusty plain, toothless chainsaw zone, where there's just, I mean, all the phones are like phone booths, and there was just, it was very primitive, and the gas, you know, there was no way to file. There was just no way to file. Like, even the motels didn't have phones in the rooms, and all there was a phone booth, and I couldn't get into this damn phone booth. I could try to get the chair in, or I would get out of the chair, and then I'd be on the ground, and I couldn't coax it just wouldn't work, and I finally just gave up. I missed the deadline anyway. It drove me nuts. And, you know, a typical Protestant, you know, work ethic, fanatical American, you know, oldest child male is like, oh God, they're going to fire me now. Oh, no, it's all over. I blew it. You know, it's terrible. You know, I'm trying to do this totally absurd, ridiculous thing. And McChesney gets on the phone, I remember, and he says to me, you know, why the hell didn't you file? You know, what happened? And I'm sweating all over, and I'm just all freaking out, and I'm, well, I couldn't get my wheelchair into the phone booth. Well, okay, you know, and he didn't get it. You know, he couldn't get the wheelchair into the phone booth. He just didn't get it right away. And then I really don't know what happened. I don't know what his reaction was. I don't know if he really didn't know or what the exact story is. But then the rest of the week, for the next 2 weeks, people from NPR would call. John, I heard the most interesting thing about you the other day. is it true? You know, and all these editors and these employees and stuff. You know, I felt like But out in Oregon, you know, where everyone's a hippie, and we used to hang with all these, you know, it's like I felt like I was, you know, coming out of the closet, you know, and like I got lots of support, you know, from my friends and stuff.
You know what I'm wondering? How you feel about doing a studio-based show now after having been, you know, a foreign correspondent for over a year and a half? I assume that most of your interviews are going to be from the studio because you're going to have so many to do. It's going to be hard to get out of that studio, John.
No, I know. I want to ask you about this, Tara. I don't, you know, I actually, it's kind of weird. It'll be strange. I mean, also it's strange, you know, to get up in the morning and, you know, have a 9-to-5 kind of a job.
Mm-hmm.
But because you're sort of working all the time when you're in a foreign posting. But I mean, the advantage is definitely, I mean, one of the frustrations about being a foreign correspondent and doing news so much is that you don't get a chance to, I mean, you're witnessing extraordinary events, but you don't get a chance to kind of kick around the ideas that come out of them. So hopefully in this show, you know, it's certainly something that I want to do is really talk about some of the things that have happened, especially after this year. My God, I mean, what a year.
John, I look forward to hearing you on the air every day now in your new program, Heat, which premieres in March on many public radio stations. Welcome back to the States, and thanks a lot for talking with us.
Well, it's nice to be back. Thank you very much, Terry.
John Hockenberry has been my guest, and he's a reporter with NPR, and for about a year and a half, he was stationed in the Middle East reporting from there, and his new show, Heat, begins in March. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.